State Representative Jackie Chan of Quincy is in his office on Beacon Hill during school vacation week, so that must mean something's going on, Jackie.
Yeah, Joe, as those who know, during school vacation week, the status is extremely quiet. People, take their families to places during school vacation week like everybody else. And while I do not have kids or a family, I take the opportunity to try to get some stuff done around the house, especially since the budget debate starts next Monday. And it consumes anywhere potentially between 10 or 14-hour days, depending on how things go in debate. Or sometimes it may be shorter, maybe 7 hours. And the next day becomes like 15. You just don't know. So school vacation for me personally is a good time to get a lot of stuff done before we start the budget debate. And the state house is quiet. I mean, that is how school vacation week works. So I'm in the building today because I have a couple of representatives who want to get together with me today to talk about some issues that are important to them. And they want to do it in person, which is very refreshing. And going out of the way from other parts of the state. So one of the advantages of the state house is parking for reps. And it gives people the opportunity to find parking and get together up here, as opposed to, making them drive down to Quincy, and then pick a place and find parking and all that stuff. This is simpler.
So when you say budget debate, are you debating amongst your fellow House members or debating with the Senate? How does that work?
Well, each branch debates the budget separately. Pursuant to the Constitution, the House goes first on any kind of appropriation bill. Very much because, after all, it's like Congress in that sense. And Congress is based on our Constitution because the U.S. Constitution is based on the Massachusetts Constitution. And as we are talking right now, the intercom just went off in the here saying the full formal sessions will begin at 11 a.m. on Monday. So they already announced the formal session time, while we're sitting here together. So we're that's how it goes. So it's about a $63+ billion budget. Start debate on. I believe there's. I got to look at it again, but I believe it's 1,712 amendments.
Wow, okay. That's going to take some time to weed through.
Yeah, and this is also the week that's House Committee on Ways and Means gets to review all amendments prior to the start of debate. So amendments are due to Friday prior before 5 p.m. And then this is the week that House Ways and Means staff weeds through all that stuff, categorizes them, reviews them, and starts the recommendation process to the House Chairman. And then we will go into debate next week. We don't actually do not know the recommendation from the House Chairman, but you do get a chance to try to make your case, and you never know. Maybe you change someone's mind along the way.
Oh, okay. So amendments could be what? Additions, subtractions, equal funding? What could they be?
Most of them always additions. I mean, no one ever cuts the budget.
Right,
Let's
right,
be
right.
honest about it. Everybody's got a project at home they want to pay for, or there's a state agency you feel should get more funding because it's a programmatic issue that's important to you, or you're trying to put in some outside sections, which is a policy piece of a pending bill, sometimes at some place in third reading or ways and means that you want to get some attention for. The reality is, folks, about 95% of all amendments are rejected anyway. But a good chance for us to advocate. And since all of us are us in the building, it gives members a chance to grab chairman and ch chairwomen, like to advocate for their bills too.
Sure.
So there's always this opportunity for us to get together, in the hallways, in the offices, in the House lobby, even on the floor, to talk to other members about things that are important to them, to try to get some advocacy in. And
Okay.
a lot of this conversation occurs long before anything happens in the House floor because people have this misconception that everyone makes decisions on the fly in the House floor. No, you start grabbing people, in person because you just want to have a conversation as opposed to like trying to make a phone call or a Zoom call. So as soon as you see them and say, "Look, I got this going on. Can we talk about this now?"
Yeah. Do you have any amendments, Jackie?
Yeah, we have some local amendments. Bruce and I split them up. The speaker, being the speaker, doesn't file any amendments because he is the speaker. However, there are other ways for the speaker to accomplish his goals since he is the speaker. We filed some stuff for Quincy Region Resources again and Germantown Neighborhood Center and QCAP on different programs they're working on. We have some funding assistance for agencies under the Office of Consumer Affairs. They took a funding cut of 7%. So we're trying to see if we can restore a little bit of funding. Otherwise, it's going to result in customer service problems. So yeah, nothing too exciting, just some local projects and trying to help out one of the agencies that we help oversee.
Yeah. Is there any funding proposed for the Adams Presidential Center in Quincy?
Oh, you've been reading social media, haven't
I
you?
have been, yeah.
We won't know until we get to the actual amendment completion process. And the speaker has graciously been able to get funding for that for 4 years now,
Yeah.
through some ARPA money and through the state budget, to the tune of $500,000 a year. So just remind folks, the Adams Presidential Center, which was originally the John Adams, and people forgot this was really called the John Adams, John Quincy Adams Live Presidential Library initially.
That's right.
So th there was a name change along the way, from 2022. It's actually a 50C, a 501C3 not-for-profit. So none of that money actually went to the city of Quincy. So when I say, we got funding for the presidential Adams Presidential Center, there's actually a massive misconception on the internet I discovered that that's actually a city-owned library. It cannot be city-owned. The presidential libraries are privately owned, all privately funded, or privately raised funding, more accurately. So given the fact that Adams family only has heirs and no longer around, this is kind of a very odd situation regarding a post president's 200 years after the fact of putting a library together. And if you get super duper technical, I mean, on the Adams Mansion property, the Adams Library is there. John Adams and his whole family's personal book collection is a physical structure separate from the main building. It is a teeny tiny structure, which is not unheard of for the time period, obviously, made of granite, and it's lovely, and it's has modern amenities like electricity, but it also has like special climate control because the books are ancient. So the Park Service actually has to maintain a specific climate inside that very old building, for book preservation. And if you had never visited Adams Mansion, the place does have electricity. I mean, it was lived in up to the early 20th century,
Yes, oh
so
yes.
it has gone many mod what we consider modern renovations. So, whether we get actually any more money for anybody's earmarks this year, I can't speak to it. We heard there's other attempts by the governor to do more cuts, despite the fact that, we are debating a budget. And our budget is just a little bit, very little bit smaller than the governor's budget, but not by much on her recommendation. So we'll see how it plays out. But, at this point, Ways and Means already told everybody there's no guarantees anybody getting anything for any project whatsoever.
Right. And so how does the, I should ask Senator Keenan this, but how does the Senate side work, tech? Is it basically the same?
Same thing. So we sent over our version of budget, and how Senate Committee on Ways and Means writes their own budget recommendation, and they go through the same debate process. They'll debate before Memorial Day weekend. They always debate before Memorial Day weekend. I mean, we run a very, very, very strict schedule through my entire lifetime in this place, except for COVID, which was weird. Where we're always debating the week after school vacation week, which is after week of Patriots Day week in April. And the Senate always debates their budget right before Memorial Day.
Okay. Then after that, you try and come to terms.
Conference committees formed. We can talk about all the different conference committee experiences over the years on a different day if you want. Lots of tacky stories there. But they do a conference committee starting the first week of June, and they try to hatch out a compromise. Obviously, if revenue numbers changes or the economy shifts, conference committee does have some flexibility to change the numbers around, generally downward, if there's like a nightmare scenario in the economy, which is bad for all of us, because if you got some special assistance in your version of the budget, that could all get worked out in a heartbeat. So there's still a lot of things in flux that we talked about for last year regarding exactly what is going on with this economy. But yeah, they have to work on a compromise, and they would try to get a compromise done before the start of the fiscal year on July 1, which is what we actually did last year. But
That's
there's
right,
no,
Aaron.
yeah. But if we go over July 31, what we do is we call it temporary budget. So we do like every 2 week budgets, using the prior fiscal year's numbers.
Right, yeah, just supplemental to keep things going until you come to a final agreement.
Yeah, unlike the federal government, we don't close.
Right. Well, they're only partially closed now, let's be accurate.
Well, partially closed now. People keep forgetting Homeland Security is still not functioning. It's about, I don't know what percentage, but a big percentage of that agency is still not working.
Yes, they have some emergency funding that they pulled from somewhere else to keep it going.
Pretty much, yeah. So, unlike your federal government, your state government is not shut down.
Right, exactly. Speaking of what's going on at the federal level, did you read this morning about the change in marijuana regulations at the federal level?
Psychedelics or the marijuana?
Marijuana, actually, yeah.
I'm not seeing the marijuana one yet. I'm aware of the psychedelics regarding medical care, and research on psychedelics is still ongoing. John Hopkins, I believe, has a lot of stuff on psychedelics, including what we used to call magic mushrooms, right, at one time. And things like LSD is back on the research table, but very different LSD from the 70s. And those type of psychedelics are, back on the table and for research purposes in terms of whether or not it can help people with mental health issues or, other types of immune system or other diseases that may be out there as a therapy. Marijuana, I wasn't aware that they moved forward to marijuana. I mean, the issue of marijuana is very simple. It's the decriminalization. If the federal government doesn't decriminalize marijuana, which requires an act of Congress, I mean, it's very hard for the medical federal for the industry to take advantage. And my always understanding at the federal level is the FDA has a very limited window for marijuana ownership for the purposes of medical research.
Yeah, it's not deregulated. It was reclassified from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3 for medical marijuana use on the federal level.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's actually legal, but then again, the federal government seems to operate on the whole premise that the law doesn't matter right now. So, I mean, again, it's Congress's prerogative to maintain congressional power. I can't speak or understand how that's going to work. I'm doubting the banking industry, which is eagerly awaiting at some level to help fund these businesses. They were not going to risk their federal charters, because if you get a different administration, and this is about reclassification, you could have a different president reclassify again, and then they become in violation of banking regs, and the whole thing goes sideways.
It's already happened several times.
Yeah, I mean, why if any financial institutions is not going to put their money at risk.
So here in Massachusetts, as I understand, the Cannabis Control Commission has been restructured now.
Yeah, it's put under the governor. We talked about this a few times, how much they're just bad functioning organization. And we changed the size and structure of it, stuck it all in the governor's office. So there's actually one entity that's actually in charge. And a lot of the functionalities, meaning the purpose of the Cannabis Control Commission, is intact. But we started to streamline it, make it clear who's in command and control. And if someone has a problem, there's no more finger pointing. You know who to go after.
So more accountability, it sounds like, at the executive level.
Yeah, one of the things that was originally put together, the Cannabis Control Commission, that was under the Treasury, was there was way too many entities making appointments, and there were too many chefs in the kitchen. So it was difficult to pin down like where the problem child was, so to speak, of dysfunction agency, because it was multiple people screwing up based on the IG's investigation. So, what we did was like make it very simple. You're in charge. This is who's responsible for appointments. Something goes wrong, we know who to go after.
With the budget proposal, Tacky, is that takes into account whether or not the ballot question reducing the income tax will be passed?
No, because
No.
it's difficult to estimate exactly how it's going to go anyway. We could also see ourselves in an October recession for all we know, given the situation on a global level, especially the fact that, I don't know, 20% of the world's oil and natural gas supply isn't moving at the moment. So who knows what's going to happen? That's why, conference committee may readjust the entire budget if, we find unemployment spikes 1%. A full percentage point increase in unemployment happens in, let's say, middle of June, right? We're in this kind of like really unsettled situation. Not to say you can predict the economy, you can't predict people's behavior, but generally there's a ebb and flow to this thing. And you can kind of like see warning signals that, something's going to happen. But who knows? So the rough estimate right now is that if the ballot question passes, it goes from 5% to 4.7%. Some people may think that's not a big deal, but it's $800+ million potential revenue loss starting on January 1st of 2027. I say potential because we don't know what else is going to happen. And as a result, you may find ourselves cutting the budget, but the governor made 9C cuts. She has been through 9C cuts if there's a consensus revenue change by the three branches of government. The Senate, the House, and the governor's office have a consensus revenue adjustment. she can see cut the budget. So, that's always on the table, that we can just, slash and burn. And it will be a slash and burn, folks. This tax reduction will be a slash and burn situation. So if you're listening to this and you have human services or you are a government employee, if you're a public employee, you should be very concerned. Payroll is the first place we go for.
What is it?
Payroll.
Payroll, yeah. Well, it's your biggest, one of your biggest expenses, right?
Actually, yeah, well, it's one of the biggest non-discretionary, it's one
Right,
of the
right.
biggest discretionary expenses.
Yeah.
Most of the budget is non-discretionary. It's a vast majority of the budget is non-discretionary.
Right.
The discretionary part of the budget's under 30%.
Okay. So that's, I guess it's the easiest place to cut.
Is the only place we can cut.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you wipe out whole programs, but because the person who's running the program doesn't exist, the program goes with the person. So, I mean, I love government employees that, advocate for tax cuts. Well, you're going to get fired, guys. I mean, it's going to work if there's a massive tax cut. Yeah. I've lived through three different recessions. I came to working government during a recession, and it takes, up to 5+ years to recover the employee loss post-recession. The last time we did an income tax cut was, I believe, in the 2002 ballot question. And the 03 recession hit right after, and it was going from 5.95 to 5% in a blink. Instead, the legislature decided in 2003, I think it was 2003, was it 2002? Maybe 2002. We froze it at 5.95, using economic indicators to bring it down 5% by 0.5, 0.05 at a time. So, if my memory serves, and this is getting harder, as I was telling someone the other day, it's getting harder for me to do instant recall on the fly now. I'm getting older, but especially years. Like, remember when year things happen, it's getting tougher for me. So I'm trying to remember, it was a ballot question 2000, or was it 2002? But regardless, the legislature at the time decided to do incremental reductions. So every time the certain economic indicators hit regarding growth of the economy, the income tax went down. So starting around 2011, 12, actually more like fiscal year 2013, so it was like 2012. The started a rapid acceleration of the decline in income tax at a gradual level at a smaller rate, meaning that you're not losing $800 at a time, losing a smaller percentage. And then it allowed us easier to put it into the main budget because the economic indicators showed the economy was growing. But as I talked about this before, this whole concept of trickle down economics doesn't really work properly if you don't do this in terms of a gradual decrease. So you're going to, if you increase, if you decrease gradual taxes gradually and the economy is growing, that means salaries are growing. If salaries are growing and you decrease the tax rate slowly, you shouldn't see a tax shock. You shouldn't, unless you wouldn't. You may not see a tax shock, as opposed to what, you see other states and DC, they just do immediate tax reductions or different types of tax structures. And then there's a tax reduction shock, because you could have an economic recession and a tax cut, and then you have the people who don't make any more money, and then you're already collecting these taxes, and it compounds itself. It's it is very logical. It's just people don't think about it because it's very easy. It's very logical. It's just people don't really think about it because it never occurs to them.
Yeah, and then I mean, on the flip side, it ends up costing as well because those people have been cut are now on the unemployment rolls.
That's correct. And even though people do pay taxes on unemployment rolls, it is a far long, it's far cry from what your original salary is. So, it's not that simple. So your 5% tax rate, those of us old enough remember it was 6.95 way back then in 1990, right? Where the legislature had to do like draconian cuts and massive tax increases to deal with the budget shortfall then. Basically austerity. And then, they took that long, it took decades to recover our bond rating. It was all kinds of chaos in terms of the recovering programs and restoring state government in terms of functionalities into the late 1990s. Then you had another dot-com bust, resulted again layoffs and program reductions, and then we tried to do a massive tax cut at the same time by ballot question, and then you had the 08 recession, 5 years later, and then food bloom hit 2009 and 10 is when it really came food war. And then we started recovering things again starting in like 2015, and then the 2020 COVID insanity, the federal government essentially bailed everybody out during the COVID recession, and it was short-lived. And then now we're in this, I don't know what we're living with economy, which makes no sense in a macro level, and nothing makes sense in terms of macro level economics right now. So we bring the income tax from 5 to 4% in 0.3% increments over the course of I think 3 years. You could be looking at a revenue shortfall of well past 2.5 billion dollars, give or take, over a three-year period. So does it affect you? Maybe not if you're wealthy. If you're not uber wealthy, I'm going to tell you, it will affect you. You probably won't realize until it actually happens.
Now that's the case really with most government programs and services. You don't realize it right away, but over time you start to realize things are missing.
And the odds are you probably vote against a tax. You probably voted for a tax cut,
Right.
and you.
Oh, I'm sure it'll, if it makes it to the ballot, I'm sure it'll pass.
Yeah, I mean, and the odds because of just raw numbers and the fact that people, ridiculous money, is just a small minority of the population, and you have a large winning vote to lower the taxes. The odds are that someone that voted for it probably is, losing some kind of government benefit as a result.
It's a catch 22 is what it is.
Well, people hate taxes. It's just that simple. They just don't realize that nothing's free.
Well, cities and towns are starting to realize that. There are many looking at a Prop 2.5 override this year.
But there's also the ARPA money problem. So one of the things that happened that is really disturbing, and I'm not saying it's for every community, but it's not uniquely Massachusetts. Other states did this too. They built ARPA into the baseline structure of their budgets, meaning they didn't treat it as one-time benefit. They treated it as part of the base of the budget. And as a result, the ARPA money ran out a couple of years ago, and they were able to kind of, limp along because the economy's pretty good and property values were good and houses were moving, and they increase the property value means better property taxes. Unfortunately, given the high interest rates the last year at a 7% clip on mortgages, a thin housing market, very low vacancy available, and unemployment's creeping up to 5% in Massachusetts. I haven't looked recently, but it's running ahead of the federal government. Revenues are becoming more difficult at all levels, especially at the municipal level. I mean, we're doing good here, I mean, but it was far, far cry than we were 2 years ago. They built into the baseline, and it's not just us. Uniquely, other communities around the country, as well as counties and states, did that. We did not do that at the state level. We did not put ARPA into the baseline budget. We treat it as a one-time cost. We did follow the federal guidelines and deadlines, so we're not subject to clawback. Some communities are probably looking at clawback at some point as the audits continue on whether or not you follow all the guidelines of ARPA money usage. And you're going to find more smaller communities in particular, doing for Prop 2.5 overrides, and they will not admit that ARPA was part of the baseline budget. It was only a one-time payment because they thought the money was going to be forever, which was clearly said to them it was not.
That's another key difference this time around, as opposed to you mentioned 2002. The federal government was not clawing back at that point.
Yeah, and the federal government historically has not bailed out states. That's what made COVID unique. The fact that they were giving us money was like unreal to us because the position of the federal government has always been from the beginning of time is that, as sovereign entities ourselves, as states, under the US Constitution, our problem isn't their problem, even though they create the problem sometimes, it's not their problem. We talk about SNAP and unemployment and all that other stuff that we do for them that they're screwing up, that it becomes our problem. So that's why COVID is very unique because the fact they just did handouts to all states to try to close the budget gap. And people would forget, the country went to 18, 90% unemployment inside a 2 week period of those. And we were looking at 14,000 applications in the first week of shutdown, which basically destroyed the computer system, line system. And you only had 50 people working at the time,
Remotely, too.
remotely processing applications, of which none of us could have anticipated at the time of that. You have 14,000 applications making an appearance in like a 2 week period, 1 or 2 week time period. So, and you can see the revenue shortfall that comes with that. So it wasn't just that. I mean, like excise taxes weren't moving because alcohol stopped moving, for example. People weren't buying new cars. People weren't, getting on ships, cruises. No one was visiting hotels and motels. No one's renting vehicles. I mean, this huge economic ripple effect. And, all the students went home because they want to be with their families during a crisis if they could, which is 100% understandable, right? And we weren't collecting gas tax because nobody went anywhere. And the MBTA already had a revenue shortfall. You had no ridership. So, I know it's only been about 6 years. We're inside the 6 year anniversary of COVID. But I mean, there was a lot of economic damage and, impacts, state, municipal, county, depending what state you're in, revenues. And it takes a long time to fix when it breaks.
That might be a little bit of a silver lining this year in the tourist area with FIFA and America 250 and tall ships.
Yeah, we're hoping for a good summertime in the greater Boston area. Quincy can't benefit from it because your hotel motel taxes go straight to the cities and towns. I see none of that money. Our level. We get the meals taxes, but even then, Quincy gets 0.75% of every meal that's bought. That's why your meals tax is 7%, not 6.25%. We're hoping that, surrounding communities, hotels, are used, which means the local retailers and local restaurants, get the bleed over effect.
Right, absolutely, and it is, there's, I don't know, taxi services that might benefit from that. You just, you don't even have anticipation as to how the economy will impact that.
Yeah, Uber and taxis, but also the MBTA. Ridership generally lower in the summertime on MBTA because of people on vacation. On the flip side, it's compensated by tourism. And tourism has been really tough the last several years for many reasons. People here don't realize that people do watch our news from overseas and what's going on here. And they find that if America in general, not necessarily Massachusetts or Boston, but in general, if America is unwelcoming and not safe, they choose another destination. And the US dollar has been fluctuating all over the place, but generally it's still weaker than it was 3 years ago, which means that your purchasing power coming into the US is better. However, I've repeated multiple times the Trump administration increasing visas by $250 a person means that $250 of spending power that could be spent locally and local businesses is now evaporated. Which would change foreign tourist spending habits. I've been told by folks FIFA will probably not be a big problem because a lot of people coming to FIFA are tend to be more affluent.
Oh,
Not
interesting.
all of them, but a lot of them tend to be more affluent, so they're probably able to absorb the extra 250 per person visa plus have enough money around to spend on whatever they do when they visit. But I'm sure there's also folks that are not as affluent that those visa costs, and they're going to really have to reconsider how they spend their money here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and airfare is going to be more expensive with this energy crisis right now, too.
I think we're getting a crash course on how one little piece of water impacts the global economy. Jet fuel, plane fuel, is a global commodity too. Most of us didn't realize that. We've never had a jet fuel crisis before, to my knowledge. So the Europeans, I think I mentioned this last week, Europeans have a 6 week backup supply of fuel, and they believe that if something doesn't happen in the next several weeks, they'll burn through their reserves and that they have to reconfigure all the flights. China has already canceled flights. I don't know if you've seen the CNN article on that, but CNN Asia has articles and interviews of people overseas out of country, anywhere out of country from China getting notices that the flight's been automatically rebooked
Is that right?
without their knowledge. Well, they get a text message or email, but They didn't ask for the rebook, and it was because of fuel shortage. The Chinese
Interesting.
has like 1.5 billion dollar 1.5 billion gallons ish of reserves available, so they can kind of last a little longer. But if there's refineries are not receiving energy, receiving the oil, then they're not going to refine or shut down the refineries. I remind folks, not all refineries are created equal. Every refinery accepts certain types of quality of oil. Every refinery does different types of refining. So if your refinery makes jet fuel, you're only making jet fuel. You're not making gasoline or diesel. So, it's people kind of like oversimplify how refining works. And you don't build new refineries if you don't have demand. It's a waste of money. So everything's designed for capacity and need, and expandability is only limited by the size of the economy. And if the economy is not growing, they're not going to do expansion. It's not hard. So, all Asian countries will see massive fuel shortages, which will actually impact us because, jet fuel is a product that moves around the planet.
Yeah, this seems like could be a boon for Russia, really, if Southeast Asia is looking to Russia for oil.
Yeah, it's just getting it there. That's always the challenge, is the Russians have to like circle all around Africa because they're running of no transponders. So these are the ghost ships, the hidden, the phantom ships of the Russian fleet that's not running on transponders. And you may remember that they had a ship trying to get to Venezuela that didn't disclose it was a Russian ship till the U.S. started board U.S. Navy. I'm sorry, U.S. Coast Guard, not Navy. U.S. Coast Guard started boarding those ships. Meanwhile, there was a humanitarian oil tanker that was flagged Russian on the way to Cuba, which actually doesn't solve the Cuba problem, but it's a long, their electrical grid system's a mess. But it will help alleviate the problem, but it'll take weeks for the alleviation to make an appearance. Put in perspective, guys, Russia was discounting the oil about up to 20% per barrel. So the economic stranglehold was pretty hard for them to continue the war in Ukraine, which means they were basically deficit spending on a weak ruble. They were trying to basically just do deficit spending on a weak currency. And then because there's war and gas, oil prices you've seen fluctuates between 90 and like $110. The Brent is what you want to look at, not the West Tech Brents. You may want to look at the Brent. The Russians, generally charge a 20% discount. So when they were paying, people were paying $50 or less, now they're paying $80 or more for Russian oil. And most people don't realize that's the wholesale price, not the retail price. So the retail price for oil on the international market is generally $30 above the price you see on wholesale.
This morning it was 103 something a barrel.
So that means the retail price is 133 to 140, depending on what you're talking about. So it's generally I generally apply $30 above, over $30. Surely you can go as high as 40 or 50 if the demand is high. So what you see on the news is the wholesale price. It doesn't reflect the actual retail price when it gets to the facilities that actually sell the fuel or sell the oil. Sell the oil to the refiner, the oil refinery refines it, and then the wholesaler is the wholesale price. So you want to get your markup, right? And then refiner want, we then mark it up, and then it gets to the retailer, then marks it up again. So you could see, if it's 103, maybe 133 or 140, depending on, what country we're talking about.
And it impacts everything basically that we touch.
Well, again, the Asian countries combined, with China leading the way at almost $19 trillion, represents probably just about 25% of the global economy. Because because China, Korea, and Japan together, crosses over the $30 trillion barrier, which is basically the same size as the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy is representing just about 20% of the global economy.
So it's certainly something that's going to bear watching this year for sure.
Yeah, again, it's going to be an economic slowdown. And as refineries shut down because they don't have anything to refine, it can take weeks depending on the refinery to restart. Same thing with the oil wells. All those oil wells are shut down, including the Iranis. And they just fill up the fuel storage tanks. But to reactivate a well can also take weeks. There's a whole process to reactivate because you just don't turn a switch and a couple of valves. It doesn't matter what country you're in. There's a whole safety protocol because every drop of oil is precious for dollar purposes, and that incentivizes them not to screw it up.
What's going on locally these days, Jackie?
No, it's been obviously pretty quiet this week. I saw some stuff at City Hall. The city does a great job again at City Hall regarding family events during long holidays. Obviously Patriots Day week is over and the marathon is over.
Yeah, I didn't see you in the marathon.
You see me in a marathon, I trust you, it's a clone.
It's an AI generation of tacky in
Oh,
the
you see a social media of me in a marathon, I promise you it's AI.
marathon.
So I don't, there's not too much else going on. I mean, I know that the Lions Club site anniversary next week, Dr.
Yacoubian.
Yacoubian, thank you,
Yes.
is being recognized. Congratulations to Dr. Yacoubian. I know a week after that, QCAP has their annual award ceremony.
Yep.
And I'm getting a lot of invites now for Asian American Pacific Islander Month. This is part of a job that people kind of forget about, that I have a bit of a statewide presence in that in the community. And I'm trying to go through the list of invites because I am no way getting to all these things on top of the local stuff I'm trying to get to, plus, of course, statehouse stuff.
Sure.
My schedule in May is a mess as I'm trying to figure that part out.
Yeah.
No, again, this next as we reach the end of the month, is like 8 days left in the month, or 7 days actually now left in the month. There's a lot going on really right now. I mean, Park State is coming up on May 2nd. I know Wilkins will also on the beach is doing a cleanup.
Yes, this Saturday actually. And also the Neponset River Watershed's doing their cleanup this Saturday too.
And then I think also next weekend is a Troop 6 Eagle Scout ceremony. I actually have
Oh.
35th anniversary of BC High alumni, which I'm not going to be able to get to because I got to do some Eagle Scout ceremony attendance among other things that Saturday. So, I mean, there's stuff in my schedule. Just going to hear some of my personal life events gets pushed to the side in favor of the job.
Interfaith Social Services has their big Stop the Stigma 5K this Saturday as well, raise money for their counseling center. So plenty going on locally for sure. Reminds me, the folks at Dove, Tacky here in Quincy, are concerned about the loss of some federal funding. I don't know if you've heard about this at all.
I'm aware that domestic violence funding has been impacted by the federal government. I've actually mentioned this to people before, and they were kind of appalled by it because they voted for this administration. Certain issues are not party. Things like domestic violence is not a party line issue. This is something all of us should care about. And I think that is lost in Washington, D.C. today. And it's not the only program. There are many other programs that really is not a party program. It's us helping our neighbors out. So I'm aware that there is funding cuts or sometimes money reallocation. I'm not aware of the size of it. I'm not sure what programs affected.
Okay, yeah. I think they'll be advocating for some, maybe some state fill-in money.
Yeah, they've not come to me yet with that request.
Okay, all right. I know you need to cut it a little early today for your meetings, so we should let folks know how to get a hold of you.
Sure, 617-722-2 370 617-722-2370. That is the office number. We're in room 42 at the State House. If you come visit, we'd be happy to see you. If you have family or large groups looking for a tour and need some help, give us a call. We can put you in touch with the tour desk if you're looking to visit. Tacky.chan@emmyhouse.gov, TACKEY.CHAN at emmyhouse.gov. I'm receiving a whole lot of email for co-sponsor requests. That's actually part of the reason I'm in the office today, too, is to go through people's co-sponsor requests on amendments for the budget. I cannot make everybody happy, but it is. Is something I do review, and we do look closely at as we're trying to figure out what to co-sponsor. State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. It comes with a corresponding Instagram. We do have tackychan.org, which is our resource page. for folks and people who actually do use that to contact me. They use the contact sheet in there. MELegislature.gov. Again, MELegislature.gov. You can look at us on our videos and search for all kinds of documents that we have on there, including bills that are important to you. And of course, I'm here with Joe every week or so on the KOA TV at KOATV.org. You'll give Joe a drop an email. And I met some folks this week again at Fennel House. I gave a little talk there, and people commented you actually do watch us. So, if you feel like dropping an email to Joe, feel free to. If you enjoy, not enjoy, or have questions, doesn't matter the question. If you want, any kind of thing you want to talk about, we're happy to chat about it. And of course, Joe, has his 10-minute segment every morning.
Excellent. Appreciate it, Tacky. We will check in with you next week.
See you next week, Joe.